Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. And this past weekend, we celebrated International Women's Day, and we're right in the middle of Women's History Month, so there couldn't be a better time to revisit one of the leading books on the modern feminist movement. Jennifer Baumgardner and Amy Richards' Manifesta, Young Women, Feminism, and the Future, shook the minds of women when it was released in 2000. Part call to action and part history of the feminist movement, ranging from the 1800s Seneca Falls Convention to 90s New York City, Manifesta addresses the roots, fears, and goals of feminism and the work that is still to be done. The recently released 20th anniversary edition is a revised Manifesta with new resources and reflections on feminism in the age of social media and hashtag Me Too. Jennifer Baumgardner is the co-founder and speaker bureau of the Speaker Bureau Soapbox, Inc., a writer and former editor at Ms. Magazine. Amy Richards is a writer, organizer, and producer of shows, including Woman on Viceland. They're both in studio with me today. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hey, listeners, we want to hear from you. Do you call yourself a feminist? If so, what does that mean for you today? You know what? I'm going to ask you to give me the phone number. We've got a new phone number because our phone lines are down. 675-6329. That's it. 212-675-6329 is the phone number. So it's so interesting, this book, as I'm reading it, because I had a big weekend. Manifesta and Rebecca Solnit.
A good weekend, I hope.
It's history, interviews, personal anecdote. Why did you make these choices when you first decided to write this book?
Well, Amy and I met at Ms. Magazine in 1992, I think, or 93. She was working in Gloria Steinem's office. I was an intern at the magazine. And at the time, we were kind of feminist, second wave feminist fans, I guess. Mm-hmm. And at a certain point, we had this need to document the feminism that we saw around us in our generation. And part of it was, we were hearing a lot like, where are the young women? You know, we did so much and you seem not so great. And at first we sort of bought it, I would say. And then there was this moment we were like, no, that can't be true. We're passionate about feminism. Mm-hmm. And once we started looking at our generation and realizing things looked a little bit different, but it was feminism, we got the confidence to start labeling that feminism, talking about it, and eventually kind of traveling around the country a lot, talking to people about feminism, what it was, and to kind of break open this idea that there only one kind of person could be a feminist and you had to be so perfect. You had to have all of your body image issues worked out. You were vegan, of course. You were anti-capitalist, you know, that you weren't Christian. Mm-hmm. We were like, no, you can be yourself and be a feminist. And it ended up being sort of one of the building blocks of what is now called third wave feminism.
So we're all sort of the same Gen X?
Yes.
Same generation?
Yes.
Okay. So at the time, you touched on this a little bit, but when you talk to people about feminism back in the 90s, 2000s, what kind of responses did you get back?
You know, the most surprising one we got was, I am a feminist, but it was sort of less people qualifying why they weren't a feminist and more sort of distinguishing themselves from what they saw as the strident feminist. And some of it was the resistance to feminism was an insecurity. It was what Jennifer was just alluding to, that purity, mm-hmm. that there was a lot of people who just didn't feel like they were good enough or complete enough to call themselves a feminist. So people were relating to the issues of feminism, keep your laws off my body, you know, sort of the mantras that were out there, but they weren't clear what work was required of them and therefore weren't clear that they could use the label.
Where did the stigma come from? About calling oneself a feminist.
Well, I think, you know, when you look back into the 70s, 80s, and even 90s, mm-hmm. I think some of it was homophobia, for sure. But also because it's an intimidating thing to call yourself a feminist in a way. Like, what are you saying? Are you saying you're Gloria Steinem? Like, you know, what's required of you? And I think it was perceived, like, for all of us as Gen X feminists, I think we kind of learned about feminism in this historical way, so it didn't really seem like it's something we could do. We
weren't that's interesting. Yeah.
Good enough. Or everything had already been done. They had already gotten Roe v. Wade, so what were we supposed to do? And it was hard to understand and take our own barriers to equality seriously, I think. And but you have to, and that is what feminism is. It's like looking at your own life, looking closer to home, and kind of taking inventory of your power and your resources, but also having space to tell the truth about what has happened to you.
And if you look at the 70s, a lot of feminism was practiced in feminist-exclusive spaces. So women would go to a Now meeting. They would read Ms. Magazine. They would march down Fifth Avenue. And I think our generation was sort of looking around, and we didn't have those same markers, and all the jobs at Now were taken. So it was like, how do we measure our feminism? So I think it took a couple years for people to figure out that it could be embedded into your everyday and not always these... You know, I always called it an after-school activity, not always something that you just did at 3 to 5 at a meeting, but something that you practiced and nuanced every single day.
It had to stop being exceptional and start being ordinary.
Yeah. Yeah. And in some ways, that's more powerful and more integrated. And I think that was another big thing about third wave feminism. It was integrating these changes, these laws, and this philosophy that had really erupted in the late 60s, early 70s, changed society for sure. We grew up hearing, free to be me, you can be whatever you want. But it was up to our generation to actually manifest those things, which is one of the reasons we called it Manifesta. It isn't just like the playing on manifesto, which is just, you know, this like series of principles that you're yelling about. It was like, what would it mean to actually enact these things that we say we believe in? What does it look like now to be doing feminism?
Our number is 212-675-6329. Sorry, numbers moving on my screen. 212-675-6329. Let's take a call. This is Barbara from Plainview. Hi, Barbara. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So what does feminism mean to you?
So I think I've been a feminist for a long time. And, you know, really the Equal Rights Amendment, I think, has a lot to do with feminism. But my bottom line is that, you know, women can do everything that men can do, to the point of, you know, my daughter has my last name. They don't have to have the man's last name. They can have the woman's last name. Just equal.
All right. Cool. Barbara, thank you so much.
Yeah. My son has my last name, one of my sons, and the other one doesn't. I have to say, even though philosophically I'm so into it, it's caused a lot of problems. I mean, we can deal with it. They're not such serious problems. But
my guests are Jennifer Baumgarten and Amy Richards. We're talking about Manifesta, Young Women, Feminism, and the Future on its 20th anniversary, a special edition of the book. It's interesting that you talked about the way that feminists were getting in the room and talking to each other and only talking to each other. because, you know, I went on a Twitter search to just sort of say, well, if I type in feminist, what comes up? I wanted to see what some people thought who aren't feminists. And one came up, said about feminism, equality is about equality. Hashtag feminism is about attacking men. That still exists in 2020. That was a recent tweet. Just in your opinion, have people who have spent a lot of time working and thinking about this, do you try to change this person's mind? Is that part of the goal, or is the part of the goal to strengthen those who are fighting the good fight?
I used to try to convince those who didn't want to be in the feminist room to come into the feminist room. And now I've spent a lot more time focused on the people who are already identifying with a feminist vocabulary or experience and just need better tools to be feminist. But to the point about being anti-man, I do think that feminism has two goals. One is a numbers game, like let's catch up, let's be where we have not been. And the other is a quality of life game. You know, how do we sort of shift culture for everyone? And to, you know, Barbara's point, one of the examples I use a lot is Catherine Switzer, who ran the Boston Marathon in 67. She signed in as KV Switzer when women were not allowed to run. She finished that year in 4 hours and 20 minutes. Over 50 years later, women are finishing in 2:20. The man who finished in 67 finished at 2:15. Men now are finishing around 2:12. So women have gained over 2 hours and men have gained 3 minutes. So I do think that it's one, women have proved themselves to be capable, but mm-hmm. two, it's in everybody's best interest if we ask more of men.
Speaking of, let's talk to Evan. Evan is calling in from Brooklyn. Hi, Evan.
Hi. I'm calling in. I felt I really resonated with Rebecca Solnit in the previous segment saying that she rejects the rules of femininity, and that was one of the things that made her a feminist. And I feel like that's what makes me a feminist. What I advocate for is rejecting the rules and roles of masculinity and femininity. It's the roles that do so much damage, and the undoing, you know, feminism includes easily as much work for the man to do as for any woman to do, where you have to do, you know, you have to make space for people that where for for women where it hadn't been made before, and also be changing your own life so that you're not reinforcing the roles that people have to be breaking through.
Right.
So that's the hardest. And it's hard to even speak up as a male feminist because you don't necessarily want to take up the space that a woman could be taking up in their conversation. But because you were asking specifically about it, I do want to add my voice to the voices of the women who are feminists, because I'm proudly feminist. But it's, you know, it's a balance so that you're not taking over the discussion.
There you go, Evan. Thank you so much for calling.
There's so much in feminism for men, and so many men who identify with feminism. And for 20 years with us touring, we've never had a room where there weren't men in the room identifying either as an ally or, if they're more confident about, just mm-hmm. saying, it speaks to me, just as he was saying. And I think that there's ways in which men and boys are really policed in terms of their full human emotions, getting to be vulnerable, things like that. And that is a space, again, where feminism could provide a philosophy and space to let boys and men be honest about who they truly are and not have to pretend to be these invulnerable sort of...
There's a professor at Barnard University.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. My guests are Jennifer Baumgarten and Amy Richards. The name of their book is Manifest: A Young Woman Feminism and the Future. Let's take a break. We'll have more with Amy and Jennifer. This is All of It. This is All of It on WNYC. My guests are Jennifer Baumgarten and Amy Richards. We're talking about the 20th anniversary edition of Manifesta, Young Women, Feminism, and the Future. If you want to join the conversation, our number is 212-675-6329. Are you a feminist? When did you become a feminist? And what led you to identify yourself as a feminist? You know, it's interesting, you write in the book a little bit about how there wasn't a reputed leader of third wave feminists. I'm going to read a little bit. It seems that everyone in this generation is looking for those very visible doyens, as if we don't have a feminism, we can't point to the next Gloria, Angela, or Betty, none of whom, incidentally, were famous in their 20s either. Ani DiFranco magnetized girls toward feminism with her one-woman record label, an incredibly loyal grassroots following. Rebecca Walker, a founder of the Third Wave Foundation, is a popular campus speaker. Others cite Naomi Wolf's many books and her attempts to politicize ambition. Generally, though, the current movement seems to lack those clear-cut icons, which is not necessarily a bad sign. More feminists equals more feminism. Do you think that still holds true?
Oh, even more so, yeah. Yeah. Although, so? I mean, Beyonce was a big moment mm-hmm. with the feminists at the VMA, with the feminist sign behind her, in terms of just saying so that feminism is big enough to hold her. Mm-hmm. but in general, I would say I don't think there's one feminist leader at all. It's getting much more atomized, and that's great.
Yeah, we have a quote, I think it follows that passage, which by Alice Rossi, that mm-hmm. says, the public heroines of one generation are the private citizens of the next. And I do think it's more important that we have more people practicing feminism, and therefore less necessary that we have the people that we're pointing to. I do think that we get people who excel in different professions, and then we magnetize. You know, we have Ava DuVernay, who I think mm-hmm. people point to in film and TV, you know, or Shonda Rhimes in TV. And I think we have musicians like Beyonce and even Taylor Swift. And there are moments where people kind of see their feminism writ large. And I think people gravitate towards that. But I think more people are just waking up every day and saying, what can I do to name that injustice and correct it?
Let's talk to Deborah from New Jersey. Hi, Deborah. Thanks for calling All of It.
Oh, you bet. How are you?
Doing great.
And hello to your esteemed guest.
Hi.
I am a professor of theater and a founder of the proudly feminist Flipbridges Theater Company. And I, you know, since we traveled around, taught a lot of master classes, I've taught at many universities where I have encountered any number of young women who have said, oh, well, I'm not a feminist or anything. This is about taking back the word. To that, I would just say, do you respect yourself? To which the young woman would usually say, oh, yes, then you're a feminist. That's it. When you are a member of a marginalized group, your self-respect is given a special name often, since it's not a given. In the case of women, it's feminism. That's it. To open a doorway to people's conception because the vocabulary had become, oh, you had no sense of humor. You remember the bra burning and Andrea Dworkin and the anti-pornography movement. Social revolutions tend to be messy and they tend to be rigid. Feminism means you consider yourself the equal of any man, or any man considers himself the women an equal. That's it. That's where it begins. And that's ultimately where it, what it comes down to.
Deborah, thank
so
you.
I'm always, I think the clearer we are about what that means, the way we take that word back is of critical importance.
Deborah, thank you so much for calling in.
One thing I just wanted to add to Deborah's definition is I do think that feminism is not just about us feeling equal, but making sure that other people have that same sense of possibility about themselves and that we have it about other people. I think that one thing that distinguishes feminism, rather than somebody who's for women's empowerment, is that it's about elevating many voices, not just singular voices or one person.
Yeah, it's intimately involved in community itself and community. But I also think there are some good reasons not to call yourself a feminist that people have argued. I'm thinking of womanism and in, you know, other ways of having other coinages mm-hmm. that then reframe maybe the way that we think about the women's movement. And I think Alice Walker, when she coined womanism, she said that womanism could be the umbrella term and feminism could be a subset of it, which is kind of a cool way of looking at it too. So it's not always that you're scared to call yourself a feminist. Sometimes people are making political decisions.
Let's talk to Leela from Bed-Stuy. Hi, Leela. Thanks for calling All of It.
Hi. So I just wanted to call and add my little, I don't know what I want to call it, but I used to be afraid to call myself a feminist, or just was sort of questioning whether I could and whether I could then back up why I'm a feminist. And then it was my dad, actually, that gave me this book, How to Be a Woman by Caitlin Moran. And it was just so simple, the way she spoke about it. You know, like if you are a woman, if you have a vagina and you want to be in charge of it, then you're a feminist, you know. And it was just the simple stuff like that that just made me realize, yeah. And I know what you've just said about it's not just about raising women, it's about raising everybody. But it really just opened the door for me to be really confident in saying, yes, I'm a feminist, and that means it's for all of us. It's not just for, you know, the kind of crazy thing of, if I call myself a feminist, then you don't want me to open the door for me, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. You sound like you have a cool dad, first of all.
Yeah, very cool dad.
Leela, thank you so much for calling in. It was interesting, the women you mentioned earlier all happen to be women of color, and that's been, you know, an issue, that talking about the roots of the feminist movement and for whom it was. Recently, Ashley Farmer, a historian at BU, told NPR colleagues, the fact the feminist movement was so white for so long is the reason that many women of color noticed their interests weren't getting the full hearing. She said, when we actually get down to representation or creating a list of demands or mobilizing around any ideas, it tends to be that of white middle class or upper class women's priorities get put above the rest. How do we change this?
Well, you have to put yourself into community if you're a white person with other people. I mean, I had two defining experiences early on in my life when I was coming to feminism. One was founding the Third Wave Foundation, which I did with a diverse group of women. And Third Wave to this day is consistently very inclusive and very diverse and trans inclusive because I think it was there at the beginning. Mm-hmm. The other is I was deeply involved in the New York Women's Foundation and went to visit community projects all around New York City, the majority of which were dominated and run by non-white women. And so my experience of what feminism looked like on the ground was not white, was not driven by white women. And so,
and that's because that's the way it was from the beginning. And so it wasn't in the fabric of it, and you had to unravel that fabric.
Right. I wasn't sitting in an academic class, maybe at a university that was disproportionately white, thinking, oh, why are all these people white? I was experiencing it in a way that was more inclusive. But to that point, I would not have gone to Brownsville to visit this community project if I didn't have a reason to go to Brownsville to commit this. So mm-hmm. I do think we have to sometimes step out of our familiar communities to see the feminism that maybe isn't bringing itself to us.
And I think that, yeah, I think that there's been a centralizing of white women within feminism, and that replicates other, you know, movements. And it's something that is, you know, also always being challenged. But I was just thinking about reproductive justice. So reproductive justice is a framework that was created by women of color specifically to It's not against reproductive rights, and it's not a booster of it. It's a whole separate framework, and it is now the dominant framework of within feminism of how we would talk about abortion, adoption, being able to raise the children that you're having, you know, just your reproductive power. Mm-hmm. And I think there are many, many examples of women of color who've created philosophical frameworks, and, you know, it's incumbent upon people who care about these issues to make sure that you're citing the framers of the work.
Amplify all the voices.
Yeah.
Right? Let's talk to Lori Anna, who is calling us from Manhattan. Hi, Lori Anna. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. Longtime feminist, longtime listener.
You need a tote bag with that.
Honestly.
I grew up in a household that I assumed was a feminist, Democrat, progressive household. My first president that I really took under in my heart was Jimmy Carter, and the books around our house were like Irma Bombeck, you know, everything that would lead me to think that we are, you know, we are feminists in this house. It was right in the 70s. My mother went back to work and became the prominent breadwinner of our family, whereas my father, who was, for all intents and purposes, you know, a laborer who was out of work constantly just for union issues and for whatever. It wasn't until we moved to Florida and my father started listening to public radio down there, or not public radio, but talk radio.
Please, separate the two. Please, yeah, come on now.
Very different. And the Kennedy rape trial. You know, it was probably like 12 or 13 where, you know, I was very concerned for this woman. We're watching news constantly. We were a very thoughtful household, too. And my father immediately sided with the Kennedys and the male side of things, where, and his reasoning was that she shouldn't have been out so late.
Lori, I need you to wrap up a little bit.
Oh, yep. So that was the moment where I went, huh. But it had already been solidified that I was going to be a feminist for the rest of my life, and that we need to teach the men and the boys to be part of this process instead of one side over here, one side over there. Lori, and through my career, I've had nobody but really great people in my life, including men, and they're very woke, I guess, in that world.
Lori, thank you so much for calling in. Quick, if you want people to read your book, yes, and then what other book? What would you say?
Oh, it's called Minor Difference. By Kathy Park Hong.
That's one you like. And how about
Minor Feelings.
Oh my gosh. Well, I'm still reading Ronan Farrow's book, okay, which I do think Catch and Kill. So he probably doesn't need my stumping for him, but.
The name of their book is Manifest: Young Women, Feminism, and the Future. It's the 20th anniversary edition. Jennifer Baumgarten and Amy Richards, thank you so much for coming in and taking calls with us.
Thank you.
This is All of It on WNYC.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.